This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. On Tuesday, the nation's top intelligence chiefs convened at a Senate hearing on worldwide threats. North Korea came up, so did ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the drug cartels in Mexico. But one threat in particular came up over and over and over again.
We expect Russia to continue using propaganda, social media, false flag personas, sympathetic spokesmen, and other means to influence, to try to build on its wide range of operations and exacerbate social and political fissures in the United States. There should be no doubt that Russia perceived that its past efforts as successful and views the 2018 U.S. midterm elections as a potential target for Russian influence operations.
That was Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, speaking at the Senate intelligence hearing on worldwide threats. Now, Russia is already looking forward to this year's midterm elections. Some states are shoring up their voting systems. Facebook is fiddling with its news feed, but there's still a lot of work to be done. Joining us from our home base in Washington is Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post. Shane, welcome back to 1A.
Hi, Joshua. Thanks for having me.
David Becker heads up the Center for Election Innovation and Research. He's also the former director of the elections program at the Pew Charitable Trusts, and he was a former attorney who specialized in voting and elections at the U.S. Department of Justice. David, welcome.
Good to be with you, Joshua.
John Carlin is the former Assistant Attorney General for the U.S. Department of Justice's National Security Division. Currently, he chairs the Global Risk and Crisis Management Team at Morrison & Foerster. John, glad to have you with us.
Thanks, Joshua.
And Nina Jankowicz is a writer and analyst who specializes in Russian misinformation campaigns. She's also a former George F. Kennan Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Nina, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
We'd love to hear from you, too. What are your thoughts about the election this November? Are you concerned? Are you not concerned? What do you want to know about the way that America prepares to protect its midterms, if that's even possible? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Shane Harris, let me start with you. Can you sum up Tuesday's hearing? We've already heard the intelligence community make it very clear that we know Russia is interfering, and if it could do more, it will do more. What did we learn from Tuesday's hearing that was new or surprising?
Well, I think probably the most surprising thing, and maybe the most startling thing to a lot of people, was after these intelligence chiefs who were all sitting there at a table before the Senate Intelligence Committee went down and to a person said that they saw evidence that Russia was again trying these same kind of tactics to meddle in the 2018 elections that they thought were so successfully deployed in 2016. No one said that the White House had given any direction on combating those threats and on preparing for them. And the image that we got is of the intelligence chiefs of all of our major agencies saying this is a problem, they're coming at us again, but we're not getting any direction from the top, from the commander-in-chief, on specifically what to do about that. And that was revealed, I mean, I should say, to the consternation of a number of lawmakers on this committee, which we should remember is currently running its own investigation into Russian meddling in 2016. So these lawmakers are particularly sensitive to this issue, and I think we're very troubled to find that there's not more direction from the top on what to do about the next go-round.
Shane, yesterday Vice President Mike Pence spoke to Axios. In that interview, he did not deny that foreign powers tried to influence the election, but he added that, quote, "It is the universal conclusion of our intelligence communities that none of those efforts had any impact on the outcome," unquote. Is that true?
Well, that is the case that there is no evidence that there was any outcome and affecting the outcome in terms of a vote being manipulated, of a voting machine being hacked and a voting table being changed or anything like that, of changing the actual count. But this question of what effect Russian propaganda and information operations had, I think, first of all, that's a hard thing to know. How do you know what influence operations, what influence they had on people? Did it make them more susceptible to disinformation? Information likely to vote for one candidate or another? And frankly, that is not a question that the intelligence community has sought to answer. That's a far more subjective analysis. So I think that the vice president is very keen to try and portray this threat as something that is real, but in the same sense, try to almost minimize it a bit by saying, yes, there's a lot of noise out there and a lot of efforts, but don't worry, it's not affecting the election. We don't really know that when it comes to more subjective things separate from things like voting counts and ballots.
John Carlin, how does this investigation compare to some of the work that you did when you were with the Department of Justice and the FBI? Is this new territory, or have we kind of tread this ground before?
Look, I think we've learned and changed our approach over the years when it comes to nation states using cyber-enabled means to attack our country. And one of the things we've learned is the importance of, in advance, figuring out ways to share timely information, both with those who might be victimized by it, here state election authorities and the parties, and also the public, so that people have a will to take action. And then to make clear what our red lines are, that if you take certain actions and you're a nation state overseas, that America can and will respond. And then thirdly, that we can help on the defensive side to harden our systems when we think through, look at what the intelligence shows us as to how those actors might attack. Those are three things that we ought to be doing now and with great urgency when you hear what the unanimous opinion was of our entire intelligence community 2 days ago. There's some good legislation that's attempting to address these issues that's been introduced on the Hill. I'd like to see that we have a clear red line that says what the U.S. is going to do if someone meddles in our election again, that we resource some good work that started to begin at the states but's not happening at the scale and speed given what the threat is, and that we set up mechanisms, because one thing that's, look, what Putin's Russia doesn't like is democracy. And this isn't a, they're not just attacking the United States, they're attacking all of our Western democratic friends, Germany, the United Kingdom, France. Together, we could have credible deterrence if we call out what they're doing and have a clear plan to address it. And you saw a step in that direction with the unprecedented statement yesterday from one of our closest allies, the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. that the so-called NotPetya attack that had started in Ukraine but hit businesses all across the world, causing over $1 billion in damage. The United Kingdom yesterday said that Russia was ripping up the rule book and that Russia was responsible for that attack. I hope the U.S. echoes that sentiment, and soon.
Let me jump off of one piece of what you said, John, as it relates to our voting systems, and come to you, David Becker. Can you talk a little bit about what American voting systems look like right now? I mean, how many systems are there? Is it one big system that filters into lots of little-itty-bitty systems in every city and township? Are they a bunch of little systems that kind of end up dumping data into the same central repository? Like, how does it work?
So you're exactly right. Our system is incredibly decentralized. We're unusual in that regard. And every big federal election, we're not actually holding one election. We're actually holding somewhere around 10,000 little elections all around the country, all of which have different rules and procedures, different technology that's being used for those elections. And so it's very, very difficult to find one entry point into our system to change it. However, there are several different threat surfaces all over the country that could be attacked, and election officials are having to take that very, very seriously. We know that Russia is attempting to intrude into election systems. We also know that, as Shane mentioned, there's no evidence that vote totals were changed in 2016 at all. It's very, very difficult to do that. But there was an effort in at least one state, Illinois, where the IP addresses associated with Russians were able to intrude into the Illinois statewide voter registration database. They accessed information without changing it. It was discovered well before the election. But election officials are working harder than ever to try to prevent the kind of intrusions that we've seen, or attempted intrusions that we've seen in 2016, from impacting the 2018 election or any future election.
So I just want to make sure I'm clear on how the systems work, David. I hear you when you say that the systems are really decentralized, but walk me through this. So I live in Ann Arbor, right? Let's say I'm a professor at U of M, and I cast my ballot, and I'm voting, and I'm making up this ballot completely because I don't know how they time elections here, but I'm voting for mayor of Ann Arbor, I'm voting for some Washtenaw County official, and I'm voting for Michigan senator, and I'm voting for president, right? And I've cast those four ballots, city, county, state, city, county, and two federal. What happens with those votes? Who handles them? Who tallies them? Where do they go? How does that count?
So first, what happens is you're going to have your name on a voter list. And that voter list is kept at the statewide level and sometimes also at the county level, and those state and county or local systems all talk to each other. But the state is going to be usually the main voter list, and that's kept electronically, of course, and there are a variety of different protections in place there. Then when you show up at your local polling place run by your local election official, you'll be handed a ballot. For 75 to 80% of voters right now in the United States, that is a paper ballot. They're getting a paper ballot to mark. That ballot will have all of those races that you mentioned, federal, state, local races on them. And that ballot will then be handed to a local election official. In big elections, that's usually a volunteer or someone who's making very little money, who's serving their community. And I highly recommend everyone try to do that at some point. And then those paper ballots, and where paper ballots are cast, will go into an electronic tabulator, which basically looks like a really big Xerox machine. And that tabulator, after polls are closed, will start running those ballots through and reading them very fast, so we can all get the election results that we crave, 1 minute after the election is over. That is not the official ballot count, though, and that's very important for people to know. That is just an unofficial count at that moment, so we know, we have a snapshot, an idea of who won the election. Certification of the actual results usually occurs weeks later, and in most states, and in a growing number of states, fortunately, that occurs after an audit of the paper ballots to ensure that the tabulators are working properly. And that's not just because there could be a hack of those tabulators, but also because there could be some kind of error in the system. So there are a variety of checks and balances, and I think there are still some areas where we need to improve security and improve audits of the ballots. But the good news is we are moving in that direction, and more states are moving to more robust audits of those ballots so we can ensure the tabulations were correct.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. So, David, I just want to make sure we're clear. There's still a lot of digital components to our voting system, but the majority of the way that we vote today is on paper. So it sounds like the vulnerability piece is in the interface between the hard ballots and the computerized records of them. But in most cases, if push came to shove, we could still go digging through piles of paper and confirm the majority of our votes.
So most experts, including myself, agree that a paper, an auditable ballot that can be checked after the fact is very important, and good audits of those ballots are very important.
Gotcha.
And about 75 to 80% of Americans right now, as we sit here today, vote on paper in some way that can be checked afterwards. And that number is growing.
Nina Jankowicz, let me come to you. Social media is obviously a huge part of how Russia meddled in the election. What rules are social media companies governed by? Do they have any special requirements to be mindful of these efforts, report them to law enforcement, cooperate with law enforcement? What does that look like now?
Well, at this point, there aren't any laws on the books for how election advertisements are being governed. Unlike what we see on radio or TV, election or politically related advertisements on social media aren't required to be reported, although there are a couple of efforts in the works, including the Honest Ads Act. And I think because of that, social media companies were really taken by surprise. They do have limited liability for the content that their users post on their platforms, but I think advertisements should really be especially politically related advertisements should be considered in a totally separate category.
How much pressure, if any, has Congress put on tech companies to prevent Russian misinformation or meddling campaigns?
Well, I think they've done a pretty effective job of pressuring Facebook, Twitter, and Google in particular to take responsibility for what happened in 2016. There have been a number of hearings over the past couple of months, including a famous one, I think, in October when the Russian ads were displayed to great dramatic effect in the halls of Congress. And because of that, I think we've seen some interesting changes, although I don't think they're the changes that we really need to fight this phenomenon. Facebook in particular is changing the way its newsfeed works. As you mentioned in the opening of the program, they're privileging content from friends and family and demoting content from legacy media. They're also polling users in order to determine which outlets users trust and which outlets they're familiar with. It's a two-question poll, which I believe is just going to further entrench our social media filter bubble. bubbles. And they have made a small effort to try to boost local news in people's news feeds, but the users then have to already like those pages in order to get more local news in their platforms. And then in addition to all of that, Facebook and Twitter have done a large retroactive effort to play what I like to call whack-a-troll, where they are removing Russian content retroactively, removing these troll or false amplifier pages and bot accounts. But the reason I call it whack-a-troll is because these trolls will just pop right back up. There have been probably millions of these accounts, and it's very easy to continue to create them.
Let me get to a few of your comments now. Raleigh Guy writes on our website, the1a.org, anyone who defaults reflexively to the opinion that no votes were actually manipulated in 2016 is ignoring the very nature of propaganda. A foreign power doesn't have to change your vote to change your mind. We'll never make any progress on this front until people who were subjected to propaganda are forced to confront that they were subjected to lies aimed at generating outrage. Some of you are more skeptical. Michael tweeted, Russia didn't hack votes. They did nothing more than we have done around the world. They may have paid Facebook for ads, but Hillary manipulated the Democratic Committee through Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Donna Brazile against Bernie Sanders. No equal and balanced coverage of that. And B wrote on our website, the1a.org, it's simple. Trump does not want to implement security measures because he is hoping Russia will help him again in 2020. Shane Harris, I think that last comment gets at part of the heart of the whole issue, and I know we have to pause in a minute, but there remains lingering over this cloud over the victory of Donald Trump in the election, that Russia influenced it somehow. There are clearly some bruised egos over whether or not he won outright, fair and square. But how is that actually playing out in tangible ways? Is that just something that the president's critics say to needle the president, or is there evidence of that?
Well, no, I mean, I think that, look, this suspicion that somehow the president's election was illegitimate because of Russian influence, no one is more sensitive to that accusation than the president himself. And we've seen, you know, voluminous reporting on this. And when the president, though, does not believe that there was even Russian interference, remember, he's not really saying, yes, there was interference, but it didn't affect the election. He's even doubting the assessment of the intelligence agencies on that score. It doesn't set leadership priorities at the top, I think. And what you hear people I talk to in the intelligence community say is that until the president really gets on board with this idea and can kind of let go of his own sensitivity on the issue, there's not going to be meaningful progress.
We'll continue our conversation with Shane Harris, David Becker, John Carlin, and Nina Jankowicz in just a moment. We'll get to more of your questions and thoughts about how to secure our elections and social media from Russian interference. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Shane Harris of The Washington Post, David Becker of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, John Carlin of Morrison & Forster, and Nina Jankowicz, a writer and analyst who focuses on Russian disinformation campaigns and a former fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Ben tweets, how to limit Russian cyber meddling in our elections? Paper ballots and across-the-board campaign finance and communications transparency, full stop. We need provenance trails. David, I feel like campaign finance is a larger conversation, which is worth having. So, Ben, please don't be offended that I'm putting a pin in that for another day. We should talk about that. But what about that? If we just all went to paper ballots, wouldn't that kind of solve 99% of the problem? I mean, you can't hack paper.
Paper ballots are a big part of the solution. There's no doubt. Or some kind of auditable record. I don't want to lock us into paper when perhaps another technology comes in the next few years that's even better than paper, because paper isn't wonderful from the perspective of accessibility. There are people with disabilities that have difficulty with paper, for instance. But paper ballots that are verified by the voter at the time that they cast their ballot do provide an important protection, especially when paired with really good audits of those ballots after the fact to confirm that whatever electronics you use to count the paper ballots was correct. And like I said, one of the good news pieces here is that election officials are very attuned to these issues. This weekend, the National Association of Secretaries of State and state election directors are meeting here in Washington, D.C. And if you look at their agendas, probably about 75% of the agenda is taken up with cybersecurity issues and ways to improve security.
And I hate to interrupt you, but just to be clear, the secretaries of state within each state are the people who oversee election systems.
Yes, that's absolutely correct in most cases. So these are the chief election officials in each state getting together here in Washington, D.C. So they're attuned to this. They're very focused on fixing this. Probably the biggest challenge they have is creating this kind of secure environment for elections is not free and it's not cheap. And so to get enough funding, whether it comes from the federal government or from the state legislatures, that's very, very important to them. So one of the things we all can do is encourage Congress, encourage the state legislatures in the states in which we live to fund elections adequately to provide for the kind of cybersecurity that we need.
How much money are we talking about here? Are we talking about each community needing hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, tens of millions, billions? I'm sure it varies from community to community, but as we're listening to this across the country, thinking about where we live and what our elections office might need, what are some of the things that our local election supervisors might be asking for money to do or to spend or to repair or to replace?
So in those jurisdictions, there are five states right now that still have paperless systems. The states are New Jersey, South Carolina, Georgia, Delaware, and Louisiana. And I know all of those states are trying to move to paper-based systems, but that costs money to replace those. And then also there's an ongoing expenditure that's needed to bring in the kind of expert staff you need to improve the technology in the office and the security, to secure other systems other than the voting systems themselves, systems like the voter registration database that I talked about. So there's an initial injection of money that is necessary. There's a bill pending in Congress right now that would provide approximately $400 million in grants to the states, and that might help for the near term, but this is going to be an ongoing issue. In cybersecurity, there is no finish line. The bad guys are working just as hard as the good guys are, and we're going to need to remain vigilant as long as we need to use technology in our election system, and that's not going to end anytime soon.
Jim tweeted, "I worry that it gets to the point where elections cannot be held because they cannot be trusted as a way to hold on to power." Nina Jankowicz, you've made a real study of Russian disinformation. Is that kind of the end game, not just to get us to the point where we don't think that elections are even a trustworthy system anymore?
Yes, absolutely. And I think in general, Russia has shown over the past 10 years in Central and Eastern Europe that it is trying to undermine Western democracy as we know it. It's not just about election systems, but undermining trust in all democratic systems. And this sort of hullabaloo that's going on right now into the Russia investigations, the partisanship that's really bubbled up, is exactly what Russia wants. It wants people to think that their vote isn't going to matter and therefore not turn out for the election in November, or it just wants to pit people against each other to create more polarization, moving people toward distrusting the government and distrusting the system, which then, it's kind of counterintuitive, but gives Russia a better seat at the international bargaining table. If we're not able to take care of what's going on in our own backyard, it's then elevating Russia's status on the global stage.
Nina, how long has Russia been at this? Can you talk us through a little bit of the history of Russia interfering in campaigns? I think we've been hearing about Russia interfering in other countries more in recent years, from Crimea to this election. But how long has Russia been at this, and when did we begin to realize that Russia had some skill at this?
Well, I think if you asked our allies in Estonia, they would tell you that it started in 2007. So Estonia, you might know, and this is a topic of a book that I'm working on now, The Greater Russian Interference Across Central and Eastern Europe. In Estonia, it's the digital republic, many people call it, or e-Estonia. They actually vote online. They pay their taxes online. They do everything online. And in 2007, because of a historical kerfuffle that Russia weaponized in order to kind of awaken the Russian ethnic population, which is about 20% in Estonia, they made a distributed denial of service attack on the government institutions there, were able to shut down all the e-governance institutions in Estonia, and in conjunction with that, got ethnic Russians out on the street to protest the moving of a Soviet statue from the center of the capital, Tallinn, to the outskirts of the city. And that, although it didn't have to do with an election, was meant to inspire distrust in the Russian ethnic population in a new government that had just been elected in April of 2007. And then again, the next year in Georgia, we saw a similar situation play out, this time with Russia using what we now call hybrid tactics. So there was a large disinformation campaign surrounding the rights of ethnic populations and the breakaway republics of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, which then was followed by an invasion of Russian troops in those areas. Then we saw, you know, the sprouting up of what we are now more familiar with, disinformation and fake news across Central and Eastern Europe, which of course came to a head, as you mentioned, in 2014 in Crimea and the war in Ukraine. So this is something that Russia is extremely practiced at. It's auditioned these tactics of exploiting societal fissures in order to inspire distrust, amongst the population. And the culmination of this was the 2016 election.
Raphael tweeted, "I'm constantly surprised how the U.S., which has meddled in foreign government elections as well as literally deposing leaders we don't like, has such a number of people who are curious that Russia might have meddled. We wrote the playbook on this." John Carlin, is that accurate?
Look, I think what we're seeing now and is a regime under Putin's leadership that's existentially afraid of democracy. And that's not true of America, and it's not true of our Western democratic allies. They're not interested in one particular party or the other. What they're afraid of is the spread of a democratic regime. And that's where we need to unite across partisan lines and say we believe in our American democratic institutions, we believe in our Western allies, and there are steps that we can take to counteract what they're trying to do. I think Nina raises good points. I remember tracking the attacks in Estonia when we were at FBI. And it's important to focus, I think, not just on protecting, although we should, things like paper ballots, but to think institutionally, how can we respond in a bipartisan way? So we could set mechanisms up so that prior to an election, you have the career intelligence analysts report to Congress what they're seeing. So in a bipartisan way, both parties can agree, yes, they're trying to meddle. We can then have what I call a dead man switch, but an agreed upon approach that says, if the conclusion is with high confidence they are meddling, we are going to take the following steps to deter it. And that might mean sanctions imposed along with all of our Western democratic allies on Russia. It may mean the authorization of covert action, other diplomatic means to say this is not okay. Undermining democracy across the world is not okay, and it will trigger a strong bipartisan response.
Shane Harris, I wonder if maybe to that point, and also to Raphael's tweet, whether this was the kind of thing that maybe the U.S. could have seen coming. I mean, the U.S. has done its own kind of intelligence operations in other countries as well. I understand where Raphael's coming from. How much do we get the sense that what is happening with Russia interfering with our elections was inevitable, predictable? Was this a ball that got dropped, or was this really something new? Did this actually catch our leadership on Capitol Hill in previous administrations genuinely by surprise?
Well, I don't think it was a surprise to people in the intelligence community or experts in Russian propaganda. I think Nina very thoroughly laid out the history of this. And John, of course, mentioned that when he was in the FBI, they were watching very closely what was happening in Estonia. And people in the information operations business, as they might call it, or who study cybersecurity or national security, they know all about the art of propaganda. And we've used it in conflicts as well, and Russia is very practiced at it. I think what was really maybe alarming, I don't know if surprising is the right word, but the way that it was just so thoroughly deployed and came at us with a really kind of a full force. And we should also remember here, too, that it was the intelligence community's conclusion and the public assessment that they put out of this, that this was a campaign directed and ordered by Vladimir Putin. This is a coordinated effort. This is something that the Russian state decided to do in order to try and undermine one candidate, help another, and as they put put it, imperil the Western-led democratic order. So the scale and the scope and the ambition of it maybe were alarming to people, but the idea that Russia could do this, the idea that Vladimir Putin would direct something like this, I don't think that really surprised people in the U.S. intelligence community.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. April tweeted, Indiana does not have a paper ballot, and I have never even gotten a receipt for my vote like I seem to recall some states do. We haven't had paper ballots here in ages, and it scares me. I wonder if we could wrap up this conversation by talking about what might be next, what we can do to protect ourselves. The midterm elections are on the way. It is questionable whether or not Congress will do anything in a super speedy fashion. So let's kind of think through what can be done. David Becker, starting with you, I understand where April's coming from in Indiana. For people who are worried about what their communities, their states are doing to protect their votes, what do you think they should know?
Well, I think there's several things they should know and several things that voters should do. We're going to need to be a much more active, thoughtful, critical electorate from here on out. And from the perspective of enabling your fundamental right to vote, one of the things everyone should be doing is checking their voter registration record regularly, especially right before an election. Almost every state has an online portal to do that. That's very important. Encouraging your state legislatures to fund election security so that election officials have the tools they need to protect your vote from any kind of foreign interference. I really highly encourage people to volunteer as poll workers. It's very hard to complain about a system if you're not on, working from the inside to fix it. And there's always trouble getting enough poll workers out there and working. But most importantly is don't let the interference with our elections, which is designed to undermine all of our confidence in our election system, get to you to the point where you decide you don't want to participate anymore. It's very, very important. The best defense about against this is for every eligible voter to show up and vote in every election, regardless of what side. And we're seeing narratives from both sides, whether it's from the left with the allegations that the Bernie-Hillary race was rigged, or the right with allegations there was rampant voter fraud or hacking or whatever. Everyone should understand election officials are working overtime to make sure your vote's going to count. The best defense against what Vladimir Putin is doing is to show up and vote and make ourselves an effective democracy.
And if I may add to that, David, I'm sure your local supervisor election will just love to hear from you, to have you ask questions, to see what the voting equipment is, to show you behind the scenes. Trust me, I've done it more than once, and I bet you 99 times out of 100 they would love to take your call. Nina Jankiewicz, what about from the social media perspective? What should we be doing, absent trying to be able to detect who's a bot and who's not? Is there anything we can do to protect ourselves online, briefly?
Well, you know, I think social media platforms need to think a little bit more about their terms of service and what content is actually acceptable online. But beyond that, I'd like to see them and our government invest more in media literacy and civics programs. This is something that, you know, we've seen work in countries like Finland and Ukraine. Of course, we can't copy those systems exactly because of how decentralized our government is. But we need to be thinking about this from kindergarten on up and think about it in terms of professional development programs, too. We have not updated our media literacy curriculum for the digital age, and people need the tools to be discerning voters and to participate in a civil conversation about their democracy.
And briefly, John, what about from an intelligence standpoint? What needs to happen from here?
One thing we're seeing, which is good, is that there's agreement about what happened and that they're determined to have it happen again. What I think we should focus on is agreement as to what we will do if it happens again. So hope to see a focus on that leading up to the 2018 election.
Shane Harris, before we let you go, what's next from Congress's perspective? Are there more hearings that we should be keeping an eye out for, more testimony we should be listening for? What's the next step on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think there's going to be some of this legislation that we've talked about. There'll be more pressure for sure in the run-up to the midterms on social media companies to be policing their content. That's going to run up against some very difficult First Amendment issues, which I know are close to your heart, Joshua.
Right.
And, you know, I also think that we're going to be seeing more from these congressional investigations into Russian meddling. The Senate Intelligence Committee, that is really the one that I think is the most robust. The House Intelligence Committee has kind of had some difficulties there, to put it mildly. But we're going to be seeing more, I think, in the way of, or expectation anyway, of reports coming from lawmakers about what they have learned about Russian meddling and what was the pervasiveness of it and what we should be doing to prepare for 2018. This was just the preview, I think, that you saw this week of what is going to be a constant theme on Capitol Hill of if we are doing enough to prepare for this disinformation campaign again.
And what about from the White House? What can we expect there?
Boy, until, not to repeat myself, but I think until the president really decides that this is something that is a key priority for his administration to prepare for, I don't anticipate a major shift in policy. I mean, you still have President Trump really only on a few occasions really even paying, frankly, lip service to the idea that the Russia meddled, and is still very much stands in contrast to the unanimous view of his intelligence community.
That's Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter at The Washington Post, David Becker of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, John Carlin, currently chairing the Global Crisis and Risk Management team at Morrison & Foerster, and Nina Jankowicz, writer and analyst. Thank you all very much for talking with us. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.